have Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today is Wednesday. Dead Reagan Week continues. We're going to check out the contents of a presidential Palm Pilot. Of course, Barbara Streisand refuses to put the liberal agenda on hiatus out of respect for Ronald Reagan. Right now, I'm joined with Mark Riley, Stu Ellicott are both here.
Good morning.
I was on Tough Crowd last night with Carrot Top, who took his shirt off and attached the mic, the clip-on mic, to his nipple. It's always a prop thing with that guy. You know what I mean?
Whatever turns you on.
He'll be back next week, I take it.
Yeah, I'm doing it tomorrow, too. I always forget to announce it because I just assume that people aren't going to watch it out there. But somebody watched it and sent this letter in. Mark, I love Morning Sedition and get to listen to about 2 hours of your program every morning while I get ready for work and during my commute. Anyway, last night I stay up late just to watch you on Tough Crowd. The program comes on and there's Carrot Top, and I hate Carrot Top, but I decide to watch anyway. And then all of a sudden I'm watching Carrot Top take off his shirt and hang his mic from his nipple. And much to my surprise, he's totally built. So then I was all, why the hell am I so hot for Carrot Top? Of course, I blame you for this. Brian, Hasbrook, New Jersey.
Did you all date in a previous life or something?
No. The thing was, is Colin tried to, you know, he was making good television. Because Rich Voss and Carrot Top are all sort of like they're, you know, spend a lot of time at the gym. You know?
Oh, okay.
There's only two ways to, you know, get the kind of bodies they have. That's either, you know, sort of like unemployment, not much work, or prison. And
what about Balco?
No, I don't know, but the dudes are ripped. So Colin's like, you know, take your shirts off. And, of course, they did.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to sit there with the other guy, Jim Florentine, who's on my right, looking at, like, this weird strip show with Carrot Top, who's the last guy you want to see without a shirt on. You
know,
it was like looking at a ripped clown. You know what I mean? Because he's got that red hair, the weird face. And it's like, wow, Ronald McDonald has got pecs.
But Brian was hot for him.
Of course he was. Everyone has that clown screwing fantasy. You know, doesn't everybody? Maybe too much information. So, UN Security Council, 15-0 endorsement Tuesday of the U.S. resolution backing the transfer of sovereignty.
Sovereignty, you got
sovereignty
it.
Sovereignty in Iraq. But the weird thing about this is all these countries are in, but no one wants to send troops, right? So, like, out of the, like, Germany, Canada, France, Russia, they're not going to send any troops. No one's going to send any troops. But what does that mean? Is it because they just want to make themselves available for support? Like, hey, you can call us if you're having trouble. Or is it really a blame dispersal resolution? I mean, is that what's going on? Like, if anything goes wrong, we now have a collective to disperse the blame. It's no longer Bush's fault.
Well, let's start at the beginning.
All right.
Bush is still playing an applause track, which he's been playing down in Sea Island since yesterday afternoon when they actually approved this resolution, because this, I think, as far as his administration is concerned, has gotten him off the hook. I think that's what he thinks.
That and Tenet's resignation.
Shalabi's
gone.
A couple of jobs created. This is nirvana for this guy.
So you're saying that this administration is working towards a policy to where eventually they can go, what about the Iraq war? And they can go, huh?
What? We did it. We took care of that.
Yeah. No problem.
Although, there are a couple of obstacles still in the way. As you very correctly point out, Mark, 4 of the 8 members of the G8 summit, France, Germany, Russia, and Canada, are not sending anyone to be part of that multinational force.
Not till you give us our money.
Give us our money. Now, France and Germany finally got on board after they managed to fashion a compromise over how much authority Iraqi leaders would have over their own military, which is a great way to start democracy. It stopped short, however, of granting Iraqis veto power over U.S.-led military operations.
Like they were ever going to get
no
that.
No one is going to tell the Americans what to do, period, end.
Except for George W. Bush.
Now, the multinational force led by the United States will stay in the country unless or until the Iraqi government asks them to leave. What are the chances of that? None.
I.e., for the rest of time.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Iraqi leadership has already said, look, you know, we're not going to ask you to leave anytime soon. Of course, President Bush now says that this is a victory for democracy. But it's a very interesting situation he finds himself in. There are two different stories, and we, you know, a couple of weeks ago I said to the audience, watch out for the Kurds, okay?
They're coming around the flank.
Well, the Kurds are not exactly on board with all this. Okay, now there's one story I saw that moved overnight that said Kurds hint at, you know, dissatisfaction with this new resolution. The front page of our New York Times here in New York City, the international newspaper, the paper of record, says the Kurds are really highly upset about all of these goings on. And they're threatening actually to kind of secede from the new Iraq.
And they rightly have the biggest beef with anything that goes on there because they were, you know, attempted to be wiped out completely by Hussein.
They got wiped out, but that was in part because they got strung out. They felt that after the first Gulf War, to fill in a little history here, after the end of the Gulf War in 91, the Kurds were kind of given that sort of nod and wink by the Bush 1 government in terms of trying to consolidate their own situation, break away from Saddam. They weren't quite on board with the creation of Kurdistan, but they gave them encouragement in fighting Saddam.
Did they give weapons as well? Did the U.S.
Not as many as the Kurds needed, apparently, because Saddam came in there and swatted a whole bunch of them and killed many Kurds.
And they accused the U.S. of hanging them out to dry.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Now, what I think they're saying now, in the words of one old rock song, won't get fooled again.
Right.
They are now saying, look, you know, we want to have some concrete steps toward what we want, you know, the creation of an independent Kurdistan, or we're not going to be down with this. And if they nullify this interim constitution, the Kurds are not going to, they're going to get up from the table and walk.
How big is the Kurdish community? I mean, how
it's big.
It's big.
It's one-fifth of the population of Iraq. And it's very economically successful, and they're politically very organized, and it's not a monolithic community either. I mean,
no.
There are two main parties, so that's why they have quite a lot of influence.
So they need to have equal representation in this new parliamentary system that they're setting up over.
Well, they feel they have quite a lot of power. They have quite a lot of international support as well. I mean, after that, they were not taken care of after the earlier first Gulf War. The international community felt that they were really badly treated. So they have a lot. They have quite a bit of political muscle.
So theoretically, if this UN resolution has any weight whatsoever, it should actively represent them if they have that much international support, right?
They have to be accommodated, but a lot of them couldn't care less. They actually want a reason not to be part of a unified Iraq.
They have no interest. Many Kurds want a Kurdistan created in the northern part of Iraq. Now, the obstacle there is, and has always been, the Turks, who are supposed to be our allies and who have absolutely no interest because that northern part of Iraq is bordered with Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want a Kurdistan.
Didn't Turkey kill some Kurds as well at some point?
Well, yeah, there are allegations. Yeah, you know, parse it like a journalist. Yeah, there are allegations.
Yeah, there's been big clampdowns by Turkey.
Yeah, the Turks are there's no love between the Turks and the Kurds. So the issue of how the Americans deal with the whole issue of how the Kurds are going to fit into this new government and whether their end game is still the creation of a Kurdistan, which is pretty problematic for America, given our supposed alliance with the Turks,
mm-hmm.
is going to make for some very, very sticky going in this. But I think the bottom line here is that Bush is now trying to put the pieces in place to make it seem like his statesmanship in the long run has worked.
And that the forces that he's going to leave in Iraq are going to be almost like a police force, just to manage everything when it needs to be managed. Is that what he's gunning for?
Well, yeah, but, I mean, he also wants an independent U.S. military, first of all. He knows that for a lot of Americans, the idea of American troops being under the supervision of anybody else is anathema.
Can't happen. Has it ever really happened?
Well, let's see what happens.
In World War II, wasn't there some with the British? Wasn't there always a point of contention?
Well, there was a contention there too,
right?
Over exactly who was going to lead, and it ended up being Eisenhower. Certainly in Europe.
Well, we can see what happens later today. Because tomorrow? Isn't Bush meeting the new premier of Iraq tomorrow?
The president
today.
Not the prime minister. No, he's meeting Ghazi al-Yawar.
So two symbolic heads of state are going to meet and talk about symbolic things.
Yeah, they're meeting this afternoon. In fact,
yeah,
it's all a big photo op.
Yeah,
it's one big photo op. I mean, the good thing for George Bush and all of this now is that it's all so symbolic, and it all looks good and it all sounds good. And now, while he's down on Sea Island off the coast of Georgia at this meeting of industrialized countries, fishing and biking around his mountain bike and shaking hands and having one-on-ones with Tony Blair and the and the Iraqi leader and Silvio Berlusconi of Italy and everybody else. He's, you know, he's looking good. He's but meanwhile,
not according to the approval ratings.
Rumsfeld, he's trying to look good on TV. Meanwhile, Rumsfeld was the one who just did that tour through Southeast Asia, trying to drum up support for more troops from countries like Bangladesh, who all said no.
Yeah, they weren't.
I mean, internationally, they still look very fragile.
But this is also
among the European and having a one-on-one with Putin as well. So this G8 thing is very important to try and, from an image-building point of view, to try to make him look good. But as you say, with the poll ratings, it doesn't look as though people are buying it.
Yeah, I mean, his overall poll ratings right now are at 49%. On the economy, His poll ratings are 41% approve of his actions, 58% disapprove. Foreign affairs, 44% approve, 54% disapprove. Iraq, 41% approve, 57% disapprove. Now, here's the baffling one. Terrorism, 56% approval rating, 43% disapproval. Now, that's baffling to me, and I guess, you know, we'll have to talk about that a little more later, because he's clearly losing.
He's losing on that level.
And the thing is, with all of this diplomatic stuff, as it all happens, there are bombings and attacks and violence still going on in Iraq.
Still ahead, we have the president's Palm Pilot, plus liberal agenda and big fun guests and all kinds of... there's going to be candy. Come back here on Air America Radio. Twenty-one past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Edition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. Just to finish up what we were talking about before is that, you know, that Bush's approval rating in the area of terrorism is high, yet it's clear by all evidence from some studies that were done recently that the war on terror really isn't going that well, that there are 18,000 operating Al-Qaeda, you know, people supposedly in the world, that, you know, Iraq has literally become a terrorist manufacturing plant. There was no connection between terrorism and Iraq until George Bush, you know, took action and went to war with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So all that. And now, you know, they're clearly not, they don't have as much a handle on it. So they're saying, here's what I don't understand. If he's winning the war on terror, why is he scaring the hell out of us every day? Why are there threats coming out every day? Why does John Ashcroft get on TV and say things are really bad? If that's the case, then and he's supposedly winning the war on terror. Isn't he on some level helping the terrorists by scaring the hell out of us
Let me explain this to you real quick.
Lay it down for
Bush's
me.
Bush's people believe that terror is a win-win situation for him.
Right.
If he scares people, he becomes their protector. If nothing happens, he's also their protector.
But the logic of him being a protector when things are worse than they ever were doesn't make any sense. All that means is that people in fear are incredibly stupid, and they are willing to go with anybody who's in charge, even though this is the guy that has made terrorism worse.
Well, see, when they're scared, they don't think about that. They just look to the White House and figure who's there. He's there. He wins.
This is why Reagan was so celebrated, is that, you know, this is a guy that despite everything that was happening in the world and all the heinous evils that he was responsible for, people could look at him and actually say, well, God, if that guy feels so good, why the hell shouldn't I?
Let me tell you what Bush's real Achilles heel is, and this is just my own judgment. You look on the ground in Iraq, and people are starting to notice the extraordinarily high number of National Guard and reserve troops that are being killed on the ground. So far, in the month of June alone, 9 of the 13 U.S. troops were either guards people or reserves. This is his home because 4 people died in New Jersey.
These are like the cats that you saw last week.
Yeah, the people that I saw last weekend on their way to go to eventually go to Iraq. In May, 22 of the 80 troop deaths were guard people or reserves. That means that the number is climbing as time goes on. This could have a very direct and visceral impact because these are part-time citizen soldiers whose families are sitting at home, not going to see them for 18 months. And when you push the anxiety level of people like that, there's no telling how they're going to respond.
It's still surprising to me, though, how their voices are not as public as you might think nationally. They are individually. If you look in pockets, if you look at a local newspaper in a town where, say, someone an area has lost a few people, if you click on the internet and you look at papers around the country, then you see quite emotional stories from families. What I would like to see, or be interested to see, or curious to know why it's not happening, is how come that's not all coalescing in a kind of national group. I think people feel somehow still quite subdued or unable to speak out in this in a current climate that you're still unpatriotic.
Well, but look what happened to Kerry. I mean, even now, Kerry, for being part of the Veterans Against the War, is taking flack from veterans from that war. I mean, these guys, you know, will be considered traitors within their own ranks. It must be incredibly difficult for someone within the military to speak out against the president and against the military without being bullied and ostracized. We've had guys call this show, you know, anonymously from military bases saying, this dude is not on our side.
What
this dude does not care about the military. They're not taking care of these guys, you know, stateside when they come back injured. They just now got them, you know, outfitted properly with the right type of flak jackets after these guys were taking their own over there.
Yeah,
the police department
were
sending old ones over.
But part of the reason why you're not seeing the Guard and Reserve families coalesce is geographic. When you look at how the 9/11 families have come together, part of the reason for that is because they're all in the New York metropolitan area.
Well, when you do see people coalesce, it's because it's women as support groups on bases. I mean, I've seen on television or, you know.
Around sexual abuse?
No, on, you know, women whose, for instance, whose husbands are supposed to come home and who are not there, or spouses, but particularly kind of support groups. Because I think the families of troops who are overseas have a very strong support network, you know, on base or off base, you know, wherever they are.
But I think they're also incredibly managed by the military, the publicity department, by the military itself. The military wants to, you know, let people believe that they take care of their own. And I'm sure that there are people talking with these wives like, look, we've got to keep this among us. We've got to maintain appearances. On some levels, it's sort of like a mafia dynamic. To the outside world, we must make it look like, you know, we are taking care of our own and the military stands strong.
But remember that the Guard people in particular don't function out of bases per se. They operate out of armories. They operate, you know, they're working. 2 weeks ago, the people I saw leaving for Fort Dix were working in regular office jobs.
Hardware stores, office jobs.
Their families don't live on bases. They live in houses.
I talked to a Marine once that was like, you know, a lot of times they're not uncomfortable with the duty of being in the military. They know why they're signing up for the military.
Oh, yeah.
But they also know that a lot of the reason is that it is a job. You know, it's not necessarily out of some sort of passion for the cause, because I think that they have a distrust for their government as well, some of them. But they want the training, they want the experience, they want to have the gig. And a lot of them are furious that they've been extended, that they no longer know when they're going to come home, that they no longer know that when they're going to be able to stop their mission.
Well, people join the Guard and the military and the reserves for a number of different reasons. For example, there are a large number of immigrants who join the armed forces as a pathway towards citizenship.
To get some American credibility?
Yeah. And by the way, if you look particularly early on at the names and the places where people come from who were killed early in this war, you will find many of them are people from Jamaica, people from the Dominican Republic, people who are not born here.
That's also
seek
one of,
citizenship.
It's also one of the complaints, though, isn't it, among minorities and lower-income people, is that they're always the ones that are sent out to do the tough work first and lose their lives. That's one of the reasons why these draft resolutions are popular, is to balance out the rich and the poor within the military.
I just wanted to just go back to the thing you said earlier, Mark, about President Bush making us all feel very frightened.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's a big thing that we all agree on. That
helping
it's
the
about,
terrorists, you mean?
About helping the terrorists. Whether it's helping the terrorists or not, it's definitely helping George Bush. He wants it to help him. Whether it is or it isn't, it's, you know, all debatable. But what's interesting in the difference between how European leaders are going about the war against terrorism and how George Bush is going about it is here's a news report today that's saying all across Europe, in a coordinated strike across Europe, police have arrested 17 suspected Islamic militants, including an alleged mastermind of the Madrid train bombings, who authorities say was planning further attacks. Now, they're going ahead and arresting people through multiple countries. They are not making their public feel afraid. They're just going out and doing their job and actually making the place safer.
Awesome.
Still to come, the presidential palm pilot, the Salon.com story of the day, courtesy of Robert Kennedy's former press secretary and Rudy Giuliani for vice president.
Uh-oh.
Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Yes. 33 past the hour, morning's edition. I'm Mark Merritt with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. This is Air America Radio. This is another chunk of my high school history being blasted to you behind me. Oh, my God. Oh, the first time I saw AC/DC, they were opening for Journey. What is that about? Man, did I get drunk. Anyways, it's now time, as usual, as we do every day, my guy in the White House, the Oval Office, the guy who cleans up, the guy with the custodian, he rolls around the garbage can and stuff. He downloads this from the presidential palm pilot every day. Here's a presidential schedule for today, June 9th. 8 a.m., wake up, stay on message. G8 stands for great. 8:30 a.m., wear big cowboy hat just to show there's a new sheriff in town. 10 a.m., hand over keys to pay off golfing bet to Saudi Arabian King Al Saud. Tell Cheney you'll have to find another limo. 1 p.m., use Joy Buzzer on Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin to reassert your dominance over Canada. 3 p.m., get down to business. Demand golf rematch to win back Cheney's limo. 5 p.m., as part of economic recovery plan, enlist world leaders in pyramid scheme. Kind of what he's doing.
Yeah, right.
7 p.m., tell Tony Blair if you're really with us, you'll get matching tattoos with me. 9 p.m., work on friendship books to give world leaders tomorrow.
Oh.
10 p.m., lights out. Hide under covers making nightly prank call to Michael Moore. That's it, the presidential palm pilot. Today, how liberal was Ronald Reagan? That's a weird question, right? Well, our next guest actually stopped the Democratic Party in L.A. from slating Reagan as a congressional candidate because he believed he was a communist influenced left winger, but that was in 1952. Joining us now on the phone is Frank Mankiewicz, former press secretary to Bobby Kennedy, and he has our Salon.com story of the day. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So tell us how Ronald Reagan was seen as a liberal by you early on. That seems very surprising to me.
Well, it was a long time ago. I think it was in 1952.
Uh-huh.
I may be off a year or two.
What was it about him that made you think he was a liberal? What were his policies?
Election year, and there was a vacancy in Los Angeles County for Congress.
Uh-huh.
And the County Central Committee appointed a special committee to endorse a candidate.
Yes.
For four or five of them running. Mm-hmm. One of them was Ronald Reagan.
Was this his first political office attempt?
This is for a for the Democratic nomination for a vacant seat in Congress in the San Fernando Valley.
Let me get that right. Democratic nomination, Ronald Reagan for Congress. And what were some of his views that made you suspect of him?
Well, I'm trying to recall, but uh-huh. It seemed to me they were too sort of orthodox liberal, and the district was not one that we thought we could win with a sort of ordinary, maybe even an extremely liberal candidate. So we went for one of the others.
So let me just make sure I understand this. At that time, Reagan was a Democrat.
Oh, he was very much a Democrat.
He was liberal.
Yeah, well, so he said. Sure.
And so is this, in your view of the history of Reagan, was this a guy at that time that would do anything to get into the political ballgame?
No, I don't think so. I think he later had a legitimate change of point of view.
Yeah.
Particularly when he was working for General Electric.
Oh, that changed his point of view, working for the corporation?
Well, it depends. You know, you meet a lot of different people. You tend to agree, I think, generally with the people you associate with every day, all day. At least you did in the 50s. You certainly had your mind open.
So he was...
He was very impressed by, among others, Barry Goldwater.
Okay, so he was pulled over to the other side by charismatic, ideological people.
I think that's a fair statement.
Tell us, Frank Mankiewicz, if you would please, about how much of Ronald Reagan's impact on America as a politician was due to his immense tie or his influence from Hollywood and his personal charm, and how that clouded people's judgment about him politically.
Well, I think they misread Ronald Reagan by not taking enough account and serious account of the ways in which Hollywood influenced him as a president and as a candidate. He, after all, grew up in Hollywood. That was his background. His job every day was to take a script that some really good screenwriter had written at Warner Brothers, memorize the lines, get some coaching about what the character was in the movie, because you never saw the whole film, of course, until it was all done.
Yeah.
And go out and deliver those lines and be that actor, be that person. And those were significant acting roles. I think it's in Hollywood that Reagan learned, almost instinctively, from the scripts that he was acting out, at least what Hollywood thought real Americans did and how they had influence with others. Reagan, after all, was a very popular actor.
Yeah.
I think he ever played a villain in the whole stretch of his career. He was always the friendly, plain, outspoken American in the movies.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt that last part. Yeah, thank you very much, Frank. It's great talking to you. And, you know, he certainly was, a great actor throughout his presidency, where arguably some people would think he was a villain.
I got to take issue with something. I mean, he said that, you know, Reagan read lines from great script writers. Does that include the legendary Bedtime for Bonzo?
Bedtime for Bonzo.
I mean, yeah. Was there a great script writer behind him and the monkey?
I think it was very interesting, though, that, you know, he had this, like, that he was that, you know, malleable early on. I guess everybody is, but a lot of people don't think of Reagan as a guy who was, one, a Democrat, two, a liberal, and then, you know, through GE and Barry Goldwater was sort of like Manchurian candidated, you know, into this sort of, you know, Republican.
Idea. Well, the other thing is, I mean, we're talking now about a time, I mean, Ronald Reagan was no kid when all of this happened. Ronald Reagan in 1952 was 41 years old?
Yeah, everyone has to have that weird cathartic moment,
yes.
Not unlike Rudy Giuliani, who is
not him.
There's some gossip that he might be the new vice president, presidential. He's going to step in for Cheney. He's going to be the candidate. You know, Cheney's going to be out for, you know, any number of reasons, you know, being that he's corrupt, he's got a bad heart in both ways.
And I think Spoke has acknowledged this week that he was, didn't he speak this week to a lawyer or an investigator or somebody about naming Valerie Plame, Joseph Wilson's wife, as the CIA
Bush spoke to a lawyer.
Didn't something happen with Cheney this week as well? He's looking more vulnerable on that. No?
Well, he's just pretty vulnerable in general. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways. But also, I think if he were to be pushed aside, it would be another attempt for Bush to sort of clean up, you know. But he'd certainly still be within the administration. But Giuliani, this is a guy whose cathartic moment, as a control freak who single-handedly destroyed New York in a lot of ways, really stepped up, you know, for 9/11. His biggest success was George Bush's greatest failure. And now he's being spoken of as possibly a VP candidate.
I don't believe it. I believe it's a kind of floating. People have been speculating about this for some time. I'd be really amazed if he picks Giuliani.
Well, first of all, we ought to let people know this is, at this point, gossip. Okay, this was on a gossip page. And, you know, in many instances, you do end up seeing news stories coming off the gossip pages. So maybe you shouldn't dog it for that. But I think you're right, Sue. I think that Rudy Giuliani, because, A, he very heavily courted John McCain in 2000 against George W. Bush, he is an unreliable Republican as far as many in the right wing of the party are concerned, because he's pro-choice, he's pro-gay rights. He endorsed a Democrat. The first thing he did when he was mayor of New York City was endorse a Democrat for governor, Mario Cuomo, who, by the way, lost. And George Pataki and Giuliani, who's the current governor of New York, have been on the outs ever since. He's not a reliable Republican to a lot of people.
But that's because he was like a New York politician, and he had to, you know, cater to a lot of people. But I don't think we've even seen his
colors. And the 9/11 Commission dissed him on his record.
866-303-AARO. 866-303-2270. Sedition at airamericaradio.com. What do you think of Giuliani as vice president? What do you think of that, callers? Call us, Air America Radio. Five past the hour. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. We're taking your calls, 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. I want to clear something up. I didn't mean to suggest that Cheney was being pushed aside because he was corrupt, evil, and on the wrong side of everything, and also as dirty as all of them are in this intelligence scandal. It's my supposition. I'm putting that forth. Is that I think it would be a way of Bush distancing himself from the mess of the intelligence that led up to the Iraq War.
Right. What you're saying is he is all of those things, but that's not the reason they're dropping him.
It's my speculation.
Right. Let's hear from all you New Yorkers who lived under Rudy Giuliani about Rudy Giuliani.
We got Staten Island, Aaron. Aaron,
what's up, Aaron?
How are you?
Hello, Aaron.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah. Just, lay it out.
I was just going to say that, you know, Giuliani seems to be a perfect fit for these guys because he's got this proven track record of disrespecting human rights and civil rights. And I just remember a lot of people referring to him as Generalissimo Giuliani.
Yeah, exactly. Thank
you
very
much. There was a book actually written called Quotations of Generalissimo Giuliani.
That's funny because he's disrespected human rights and civil rights with confidence.
Well, you know,
that's the
low point of his mayoralty here in New York, for people that weren't aware of this, it was a man by the name of Patrick Dorismond who was killed in front of a bar by a police officer here in New York. And he had a juvenile record from the time he had gotten arrested when he was 13 years old. The record had been sealed. Giuliani, in trying to defend the cop who shot the guy for apparently very strange reasons, actually went into the guy's juvenile record, had the record unsealed, and they said, well, the guy was no choir boy. He was arrested for this and this when he was 13. He later had to apologize for it. But in the effort to defend the cop, he just ran roughshod over the family of this guy, Patrick Dorismond, who had been killed.
He always, you know, it's like as much as he sided with the cops, call us 866-303-2270, if you would.
A lot
I
of
talked
cops
to a
hate
cop,
him.
Yeah, I talked to a cop the other night. You know, we sat down in a long conversation about how much, you know, he hated Giuliani, how much it's the money thing. He promised him a lot of cash to bulk up, you know, their armaments and everything else that didn't come through. He said to them, you know, vote for me and I'll take care of you, and he didn't, and they were pissed.
Right,
man.
Well, he made the big thing about his big crowning achievement was the fact that he'd made New York safer, lowered crime, cleaned it up, and that was all, you know, thanks to the police, and he took credit. They were annoyed by that.
Yeah. Rich in New Jersey. Rich, how are you?
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Hey, Rich.
He's also referred to, besides Generalissimo, as Adolf Giuliani by many in the know.
Yeah, yes.
I'll give you in two words why the radical right wing of the Republican Party will not nominate him as the vice presidential candidate.
All right.
Judy Nathan.
Ah!
Okay. Yeah. He's
Judy Nathan Giuliani
fit.
Now.
Obvious.
Yes.
He's too obviously an inconvenient a fit for their phony family values platform that they have. I mean, they care so much about families that one of Bush's centerpiece things is cutting aid for families with dependent children.
That's
how
right.
much they have family values.
That's right. Yeah, they definitely are liars and hypocrites around the family value thing. And he might be right, but it seems to me that they are able to absorb a lot of things. You know,
they can absorb a lot of things, but again. This was a situation here in New York that just stunned not just the media but the citizens of the city. Before telling his wife he was getting a divorce, he took his now wife, Judy Nathan, who was then apparently his girlfriend, on a 10-block walk down 2nd Avenue, Manhattan, with the press in tow.
Yeah, what a spineless bastard that is. That's how he tells his wife, by having a parade. Gene in Long Island. Gene?
Yes.
How are you? What's
up?
On your mind?
Hi, I wanted to make a comment about Giuliani and the police. Back when he was mayor, my insurance company had gone out of business, and I didn't realize it, so I had no, my place had expired, and I got pulled over in Manhattan, and I was locked up overnight for expired plates.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know what he's talking about? He's talking about being put in the system.
Right.
And the system is a situation where you get arrested and you're not, you know, you have to go through processing and all. So particularly if you get busted on a Friday, it means you're not out again until Monday. And that was one of Giuliani's big crime initiatives, was to really lock, you know, if in doubt, lock them up.
That's crazy.
Waste of money.
That's crazy. Yeah. Traumatizing, waste of money. It's crazy.
But he got credit for dropping the New York City crime rate by a great deal, which was really... Should have been credited to Bill Clinton, because he's the one that provided the funds to increase the department by 40% while Giuliani was mayor.
Wow. Sorry, Skeeter. Liberal Agenda coming up. Air America Radio. Stay with us. Back in it, Morning's Edition, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. For those of you who are wondering after the last segment why I ended it with Sorry Skeeter, is our boy Skeeter up in Vermont, who calls us a lot, didn't make the pickup this time. I just wanted to reach out. So the power of prayer, how is it helping people, Sue Ellicott?
Well, it's some of the times, I'm afraid, it's deluding people. I do believe that prayer can help people, but not in all circumstances. I just want to read you this, which I saw today. It comes off a website from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Doctors were shocked in 2001 to read a study from Columbia University that found that praying for women seeking to become pregnant could double their chances of success using in vitro fertilization. Well, I could see that praying, you know, might help if you're actually performing the in vitro kind of right there and then. Well, I don't know, would have any effect at all, would it? But the fact that people believed this and didn't laugh it out of school is strikes me as incredibly amusing. Some doctors were even more shocked at the study, which they considered highly flawed, had been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Now, they say, here comes the final surprise, which strikes me as no surprise whatsoever. One of the paper's three authors has pleaded guilty to two federal charges of fraud.
Got to be honest with you. I have prayed for someone not to be pregnant a
That's
lot.
True. Men do that. Women do that, too.
Of course, man. Of
now, wait
course.
A minute. What was the fraud? What did he plead
He's
guilty?
Trying, he would, they were trying to bilk Adelphia Communications, the cable TV company, and
who are themselves on trial,
and,
by the way.
Absolutely. Pew Charitable Trust out of, millions of dollars. The men will face as much as 5 years in federal prison. And I think that they were, it was...
I'm confused.
The Pew Charitable Trust, did you say?
Pew Charitable Trust.
Aren't they the ones that sponsor NPR?
They are huge philanthropists. They also, do they do any kind of polling?
Can I bring up how pissed everyone was at NPR? I can't tell you. Like, you know, we have been talking about the sort of the post-mortem Reagan stroke fest. And as you know, the dead Reagan is the hottest ticket in D.C. right now for Friday. Hot ticket. Bono can't even get in.
What is it, 100,000 people out in Simi Valley?
Well, right now, no, you
Make
can
them
just
forget
go.
All about Rodney
people are
King,
making
right?
pilgrimages. Yeah, they got a hot dog vendor out there. Everything's happening in Simi Valley. People are streaming by the box, having their moments with sadness. And I understand it's sad that a man died, but this was not... as great a man as people believe he was. And I just, the outpouring of support that we had around our coverage of it for the last couple of days was great. And I want to thank all you guys, but the number of emails that we got, which were like NPR's kissing his ass.
Well, yeah.
NPR's doing the respect thing.
Even some of the network anchors are starting to question whether they're kissing his ass.
So wait, okay, so it's like the appropriate time is then what? He died Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So the appropriate time to start being critical is 5 days. George W. H. W. Bush is right after he goes to the funeral on Friday. On Saturday, he's going back to Houston for his birthday bash. He's going to jump out of a plane. He's going to paratroop all by himself. Well, so I guess 1 week. Shiva is over for the Gentiles.
I would say.
It's time to start jumping out of planes and having a good time. There, of course, is our liberal agenda for today from the Streisand compound. Get your pens and papers. Here we go. One, screen airline passengers according to Aura. That's actually they're already doing that. Two, change Captain Crunch to non-military cartoon serial spokesman for the children. Three, to cheer up Bill Clinton, gather with your rich Hollywood friends and have him give the speech he couldn't deliver at Reagan's funeral. Have Carter open. Not Jack Carter. Jimmy Carter. Four, replace Republican convention hookers with lesbian sensitivity trainers. Five, finalize plans with Rosie O'Donnell for Broadway musical comedy called Fahrenheit 9-1 Fun. That's it. Do what you will.
Do exactly what you will.
Oh, boy.
So, Marin, have you checked in at Scores yet to find out the reservations? We'll find out which conventioneers will be going?
I got to go down there. I don't, I'm not a big stripper guy. But okay. Maybe I will go. I'm getting a little lonely.
Straight ahead on Morning Sedition, to torture or not to torture? That's the question for our Attorney General. Plus, we peek inside Mark Maron's dream diary and we talk sex with someone who knows about the subject. This is Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron here along with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, Dead Reagan Week continues. We'll help President Bush take those 12 steps to recovery. Corner Plus, we'll have my dream diary, and we're going to talk to Dr. Drew about the sexy, about the nasty, about stuff. I got some questions about porn specifically, but that might be me. That might be the whole set.
Wait a minute.
That's Mark Riley. Sue Ellicott is here.
Hello.
Good morning.
You think you're going to get all the questions in about porn, pal?
Well, no, I just like, you know, I got some
questions. I'm only kidding.
I got some questions. Yeah. But you ought to qualify that. Honey, he's only kidding.
Yes, honey. Vivica, I'm only kidding.
So, yeah, I'm excited to talk to him. My wife loves his radio show, Loveline.
I'm not familiar with the guy, but I've always found people who talk about sex to be very interesting.
Well, it's compelling. How can you not? And people call in. You know. Well, anyways, let's move from sex to torture, because Ashcroft refuses to turn over the torture papers. See, I have this theory that I've been trying to get out there into the world. I tried to talk about it on Colin Quinn, did not have time, that the Abu Ghraib prison, the reason there are so many pictures could not just have been some sort of perverted fascination. I believe the plan was to ride a certain line with these guys and not, like, do the type of torture where they would amputate limbs, cut ears off, or blind people. I think their plan was to actually compile enough pictures of these guys in shameful sexual positions to have to blackmail an army of rats. Like, because these guys were detainees, you know, and there were hundreds of them. So and maybe not even guilty of anything, but I thought they were hedging their bets by taking pictures of them in compromising positions, sending them out into the world with knowing that they had these pictures of them, which in the Arab community, because this is a community that blames rape victims for being raped.
Yes.
And just the idea of this type of sexualizing and putting...
Not all Arabs do that.
No, I know. Okay, then these Muslim communities, some of them. But my theory is that, like, if you cut a guy's hand off when you're torturing him and he doesn't tell you nothing, he can go out into the world with his missing hand and say, they tortured me, they took my hand, I told them nothing, follow me. It becomes a symbol of rage that can lead people. If you got a guy who knows that you got a picture of him, you know, with his penis hanging out, you know, in a hood on or on a leash, he's not going to follow anybody, number one. He's not going to lead anybody anywhere because he's going to be too afraid to do anything, but, you know, do whatever they want to do, which is rat out anything that's going on in the street. That's my theory.
Sorry, you think that these photographs, they took photographs so they could, they were collating a pile of mixed photographs so they could show them to other people and intimidate them? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that, you know, they could show the community or publicize the photographs within the community that these people were from. You know, under the threat, you know, of them, you know, being ashamed by these photographs or being shamed by them, and just so they will keep quiet and rat out their friends. You know, coercive blackmail is
right.
What I was
thinking. there have been reports that the photographs were used to show other people, look, if you don't squeal, if you
not,
don't tell us what you need to do,
they,
okay.
But actually, to have a file on them. You know, like a collected file.
Okay, directly show them to his friends, family,
right, exactly,
neighbors,
exactly.
Peers.
For as long as that guy's alive, you have this file on them in the military, you know, file in the big computer. So these guys are sort of, you know, they have to, you know, coalesce with whatever you want them to do. Is that the right word?
I don't know. I don't think so.
No. Acquiesce, exactly. And also the other torture thing is like, it's very important that we know the parameters of torture, that Ashcroft releases these papers that we're about to talk about. Because when they come after us, Riley.
Yes.
When he amends the Constitution to make himself president for the rest of time, and he goes after the liberals and the porn addicts, we want to know exactly how we're going to be treated.
Well, you wouldn't know from listening to John Ashcroft yesterday when he spent a contentious 3 hours before the Senate Judiciary Committee. What I, you know, Mark, with each passing day, your scenario becomes more and more likely, I think, because they dance all over the question of what is allowable torture, what they will share with Congress. And in this instance, it's a question of whether or not there were memos that specifically said, look, it's okay to ignore the Geneva Conventions under certain circumstances. Now, Ashcroft went before the committee. And he danced on the edge of executive privilege when it came to releasing those memos you were talking about, contending that Bush was not, in fact, bound by anti-torture laws or treaties. Here's John Ashcroft articulating the administration's low tolerance for torture.
I want to confirm that the president has not directed or ordered any conduct that would violate the Constitution of the United States, that would violate any one of these enactments of the United States Congress, or that would violate the provisions of any of the treaties.
It's him.
Look, he's so lacking in credibility. Senator Leahy, who's the senior Democrat on the committee, asked him, "You did your department, did it not, you know, issue a memo that would suggest that torture is allowed under certain circumstances, as reported in the press?" And the Wall Street Journal had very interesting pieces about this yesterday in Monday's Wall Street Journal. And he went on this long, rambling answer, and Leahy said it could take a yes or no answer. They won't come clean because they completely lack credibility.
Well, when it comes to the memos, John Ashcroft told the Judiciary Committee, and this is a direct quote, "I do believe the president has the right to have legal advice from his attorney general and not have that revealed to the whole world," unquote.
Wasn't there, what's the story about how they hired a lawyer to somehow, you know, get around the Geneva Conventions and circumvent international law to make it okay for the president to order whatever is necessary to be done?
They have lawyers. The story is that the White House was given legal advice saying that, you know, under certain circumstances that the Geneva Conventions, you know, would not apply, you know, given that the president can take exceptional measures during a time of war.
But I don't get it. So they got a lawyer on staff that could just change the law as the president dictates. It's sort of an inside job, isn't it? It's a fixed game,
now,
for God's sake.
It's a classic thing. It's what this administration does. It's not about morality. It's all about legality.
Yeah, avoiding culpability.
Absolutely, that's what it is. And it's not about being acting on issues, any kind of moral stance or integrity. It's about what you can get away with.
Well, he said, in essence, that al-Qaeda operatives were not covered by the Geneva Conventions, but he also said that the president issued a directive requiring al-Qaeda and Taliban operatives to be treated like other captured soldiers. Now, a rational person would say that those two statements are at odds with each other, that if you're going to say al-Qaeda is not subject to the Geneva Conventions, for, among other reasons, because they don't wear uniforms, all right? That's one of the reasons that he actually put forward. Then how do you say, on the other hand, you issued a directive that directly contradicts that?
But what I don't get, okay, so if they don't wear uniforms, you're free to beat the hell out of them? We didn't know he was with them. You know, we didn't know he was al-Qaeda. Yeah. He didn't have a uniform on. I'm sorry, we killed him.
Well, see, and now here's the other interesting part. Ashcroft's testimony comes as there are new revelations about the questioning of the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind. There are reports that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's office instructed military intelligence officers to, quote, take the gloves off during Lind's interrogation.
And he was the first guy. And it's interesting that he was the first guy that they beat the hell out of because he was an American guy. So it made them even more hateful. And I think in that article, doesn't it quote the guy saying that we're going to kill him, basically?
Well, they came close to saying that. What I think is important about this is that if this directive, in fact, took place, exists and actually happened, all right? If somebody in Rumsfeld's office told military intelligence, take the gloves off with John Walker Lind, what kind of a signal does that send to people who are trying to gather military intelligence anywhere else in the world?
And it's not like these guys don't gossip.
Yeah. It's not like they don't communicate.
Yeah.
You know what? You just have, you know, you raises all sorts of questions when you read that top military lawyers in the Pentagon are questioning questioning the propriety of interrogation techniques being employed to question the al-Qaeda captives in Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, this comes from senior defense officials who are leaking that to the media. You know there's stuff going on, that people are not happy that limits have been pushed, that they feel that, you know, it's kind of immoral, it's inappropriate, it's dangerous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Defense Department says that the Pentagon, quote, refused to speculate on the exact intent of the statement from Rumsfeld's office to military intelligence.
What, take the gloves off?
Yeah.
They're not going to speculate on what that means? How about it means take the gloves off?
Yeah.
Man, still ahead. Dr. Drew Pinsky, sex. Yeah. And up next, a Dream Diary. Please come back to Air America Radio. /7:19, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Here's at the interesting time. It's Dream Diary time. It's the time when some people leave the room to take a shower and some people stick their ear to the radio. Some people wake their kids up. Some people pull their cars over. But this one took me like 10 minutes to write down this morning. It was crazy. My hand still hurts. All right, here it is. Last night's dream diary. I'm walking around the city, and Gerald Ford is everywhere. Everyone looks like Gerald Ford, even the women and the kids. Gerald Ford is on every billboard, 50 feet tall. He's on every subway, every bus, every taxi. A loudspeaker is blaring things like, Gerald Ford ended the Cold War. Gerald Ford knocked down the Berlin Wall with his bare hands. Gerald Ford made America stand tall again. Gerald Ford was the greatest actor in the history of the movies. Gerald Ford won World War II and liberated all the concentration camps. Gerald Ford built the pyramids. Gerald Ford invented ice cream. Gerald Ford gave us kittens and unicorns and Care Bears. Gerald Ford was 10 feet tall and punched the bad men in the nose, and on and on. I run inside because it's so terrifying, but Gerald Ford is on every TV, on every station. All the newscasters who also look like Gerald Ford were saying when Gerald Ford was president, everyone had $1 billion and all the sex they could handle. When Gerald Ford was president, every country loved us and feared us. Gerald Ford should be carved into Mount Rushmore, and Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and Roosevelt should be erased. Anyone who criticizes Gerald Ford is a traitor and a terrorist and a pedophile. There would be no America without Gerald Ford. Anything good that ever happened in this country was because of Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford is your mother and your father and your lover and your God. Kneel, prostrate yourself before Gerald Ford, tiny person, and tremble. And I do it. Up until now, I didn't realize Gerald Ford was the greatest person in the history of the universe. Up until now, I thought he was a lying bastard who approved covert wars and let people die of AIDS for 8 years because he didn't give a crap. Thank God the media was there to sort out my priorities in dreamland. I woke up and my bed was filled with the smell of history being rewritten. Wow, Allen Ginsberg, wake up. That's all I got to say. That dream diary actually woke Allen Ginsberg from his eternal sleep. Dude, what is with this? Giuliani, as vice president, I mean, this guy, the idea, this is a gossip.
It's just all rumor and speculation.
Giuliani, can I quote Giuliani? Freedom is not a concept in which people can do anything they want, be anything they can be. Freedom is about the willingness of every single human being to cede to lawful authority a great deal of discretion about what you do and how you do it. Really? I always thought that... Shut up!
Freedom's just another word for nothing else to lose.
I'll tell you
nothing
what.
Anytime
you want to quote Chris Christopherson, I'm with you.
I remember when he said this, and yeah. I remember the response. You know, half of New York was absolutely appalled. The other half of New York agreed with him. You know, I mean, cannot be everything you can be.
That is so
Orwellian.
You're
going to use an army commercial?
That ignorance is truth.
Yeah.
It's so Orwellian. The Dick Cheney thing. So, I mean, this guy, I mean, I'm speculating, that, you know, if this is actually true, if Bush is actually considering replacing Dick Cheney on the ticket with Rudy Giuliani, I think it would, obviously it's not going to happen, right?
But I don't believe it.
But if I'm going to speculate, if it did happen, it would, once again, to detach him from all of this mess with the intelligence pre-war intelligence about Iraq and all the filth that he's involved with that these neocons have dragged him in. I don't think Cheney would be out for good, but Cheney's a dirty guy. He's got a bad heart on both levels. He's still making a salary, or he's getting paid by Halliburton. That's
it's in a blind trust. He is getting paid. You're right. He is getting paid, but he does not actually have access to the money, nor do I think he knows where it goes or how it's invested.
The draft dodger.
Yeah, but it's like $178,000 a year. It's a big chunk. You know what? I don't believe the Giuliani thing, but, you know, thinking along the conspiracy path is that I can see why Giuliani would want this out there. He didn't do too well in the assessment over his 9/11 handling when they had the meetings in New York back all those weeks ago, that the bloom was off the rose for his great so-called handling of the 9/11 disaster. And Cheney probably is quite happy with this, because once everybody starts going, oh, no, we don't want Giuliani, then maybe Cheney will start looking not so bad to the people who thought that he should be changed.
Giuliani insisted on fingerprinting welfare recipients to prevent fraud while he was mayor. These are some of the highlights of his career. I'm sure Riley's got some. Giuliani trumpeted plans to evict homeless families from shelters if parents didn't comply with work requirements. Put them out on the street.
Well, he also interpreted a law that was passed back in 1969, ironically the year I graduated high school. And the law prohibited people from creating obstructions on city streets. So what he did was reinterpret that law so homeless people, who in many instances at that time were in fact creating obstructions on streets, could be arrested.
He's the guy who famously moved on all the squeezy bottle guys at the traffic lights,
squeegee
right?
Squeegee men, yes.
Squeegee men who cleaned your windscreen when you were down and parked on Houston Street at the stoplight.
But he also made it illegal to dance.
Yeah, he did. But see, what Giuliani did, and I, again, this is probably some arcane history for people who didn't live in New York, but Giuliani finally listened to one guy about the nature of policing in New York. He a guy by the name of Jack Maple, who's dead now.
Yeah.
Who created a system called CompStat, which was an accountability system that ran throughout the police department.
Right.
And what Giuliani did, which several previous mayors did not do, was listen to Jack Maple and institute CompStat, which is, by the way, still in effect today. And what it did was create an accountability system so that if crime was going up, in a, let's say robberies were going up in a particular part of Queens, all of the cops in that chain of command were held directly accountable for that increase in crime and fixing it.
So you're saying that he almost, in a way, coerced cops to be a little over-vigilant?
No, he actually just listened to and implemented a system that was not his, that had the effect of drastically lowering crime when you put that in concert with a, quote, crackdown on quality of life offenses, which is where the squeegee men came.
So you're took credit for something.
Well, he took full credit for it, and a lot of cops to this day cringe at the mention of his name because they figured they lowered crime, and he got the credit for it. They figured they were the ones that ran into the two towers of the World Trade Center. He got credit for that, too.
But I agree with Mark Maron on this. When you say what you just said about CompStat, it makes me think the same thing, is that tends to make them, the police want to go out and arrest people even if they're not necessarily involved in the crimes that have been committed, just to look as though they're doing a good job and just to get criminals off the street. Impose that system, that does lead to the dangerous consequence of people clamping down and having wrongful arrests.
You know why it doesn't? No, it doesn't, because they also track convictions.
Yeah.
And if a particular precinct is doing bad busts, they are sanctioned for that also under CompStat.
So let's talk about the Abner Louima case.
The Abner Louima case.
Oh, let's not.
No, but I mean, this was
Louima and Diallo were the two bloodiest situations that happened under Giuliani's watch. Abner Louima was a Haitian immigrant who happened to be at a party one night when the police raided the party, and they thought Abner Louima had smacked a cop.
Right.
And they turned out he had not. It was a case of mistaken identity. But a group of cops then brutalized him, took him to a police precinct, took him into a bathroom, and shoved a broomstick up his rectum.
Now, is that in the manual?
No.
Oh.
No. It's not now, and it wasn't then.
And Giuliani did what? He didn't stand up for those cops.
He didn't.
Initially he did, right?
Initially he did. Giuliani's reflex was to stand up for the cops. He stood up for the cops in the Amadou Diallo case, where, again, an African immigrant was shot at 41 times. 19 of the bullets pierced his body.
It wasn't in his doorway.
It was in the doorway of his own apartment building. He was totally unarmed.
Mistaken identity?
No,
they thought he had a gun. Right.
They thought he had a gun. They ended up saying that, and Giuliani agreed with this, which I will never forgive him for. He agreed that the citizens of the Bronx, New York, 1.2 million people, could not hear this case fairly because of their record and their distrust of police. So they had the case moved 140 miles north to the state capital of Albany, and the cops were acquitted.
I think it's basically, you know, what you feel about Giuliani is that he did really split the city. He split the city between the kind of, you know, rich property owners in Manhattan who felt it was great to have this quality of life.
And everyone else had to move to New Jersey.
Everybody moved out, but people, you know, minorities and, you know, poor people, people who didn't have access to lawyers, people whose lives sucked in the first place, didn't have great improvements. Zip.
Well, they got pushed out of the city. They got pushed off the island.
They got pushed. You're right. They got pushed out of the city. And he also got white ethnics in the outer boroughs to support him as well, because they perceived that the city
false
was
populism.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolute false populism. But, I mean, you know, this is Rudy Giuliani, and this is the man that they are considering to be vice president. And we haven't even gotten into the whole thing about
supposedly considering.
Supposedly. According to gossip and
supposedly,
speculation.
Maybe, possibly, but we don't believe it.
Right. Morning Sedition's coming into the... Oh, no. We're not coming into the home stretch yet. Coming up, the presidential daily briefing, some frank talk about sex, and two guys named Bill talk about the snub. Stay tuned. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. It always amazes me what a deadhead that Franken is. That's like something I would have never guessed about Al Franken, is that he's this, like, deadhead to the core.
Well, he wears those tie-dye T-shirts when he comes into the office, you know.
Does he?
No.
Oh.
But he plays he plays the dead in all of his fillers.
I know. It's unbelievable. I just would never have assumed that before this thing happened. So you want to talk about sex? It's time.
Okay.
A new national survey conducted on behalf of Trojan Condom reveals that teens are continuing to play Russian roulette between the sheets, as they say. And Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us, and we're going to talk about that, about, you know, teens and sex, and about how politics impacts sexual culture in America today. Good morning, Dr. Drew. How are you?
Good morning. How are you guys?
We're great, man. Love your show.
Thank you.
So the condom company, I mean, this survey, what does it reveal about teen sex? What are the statistics that you found shocking?
Well, this isn't specifically teens so much as 18 to 24-year-olds, so it's later teen, young adult, and it's not so much shocking to me, but a confirmation, something we've known for a long time, which we've done a great job in creating good intentions. That is to say, we've educated young people about the risks of sexual behavior, but getting them to practice safer sex, getting them to do the things they need to do to protect their health, we're still lagging in that.
Well, it's a little tricky, you know.
What's that?
It's a little tricky. You got to take a minute and pause and be patient.
Well,
and, you know, get the thing on.
if you really understood the risks, it would seem, A, a courtesy to do that, and, B, a small price to pay. And, oh, by the way, you know, on my show, we kids that call in complaining, I don't like a field, I, you know, I can't.
Yeah.
It's like, then practice. These are two important issues. Get used to it. Get used to it in some way.
So let me ask you. Are they having sex, you know, younger, and are they, you know, not being educated properly?
No, those are two different questions. One, okay. Yes, they are having sex younger, but those numbers are getting better. And are they being educated properly? This is very much to the point. They're being educated exquisitely. They're just not doing what they're supposed to do.
Why?
77% of them felt it was smart to carry a condom. 4% of women, I found this number startling, felt they were, quote, responsible for making sure a condom is available,
that's
unquote.
Low.
4%.
Very low.
That's ridiculous.
So what's your take on it? Why is this happening?
Well, as you pointed out, it's something that's not exactly the most easiest thing to pull off, to really talk about STIs, STDs. You know,
easiest
and
thing
are,
to pull off?
So to speak.
Yes.
You know, I know that the reason I'm one of the things I'm doing as part of this whole campaign is to help find products, you know, find products to help kids do what they're supposed to do. I mean, the Trojan people are bringing out all kinds of brands to try to change the feel of the whole thing to make it something that enhances people's pleasure rather than something that they feel it's going to somehow detract from the experience.
Maybe a fun thing like it plays music when you open the package or something.
Well, that's a new one. We'll see. We'll take any and all ideas.
I can ask you one question that's sort of off topic, but I'm curious about it because, you know, about this stuff. How does the access to pornography, you know, change in how do you think that affects teen sex in terms of how young people are, what they know, and when they start sex?
We don't know the answer to that yet. It wouldn't surprise us. Would it surprise you if you took another primate and you just pounded it with all kinds of incredibly evocative material and it changed their behavior? No.
What I had to go through to get porn as a kid, like it was almost impossible to find. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be 14 with the...
Mark, as my radio partner says, when he was a teenager, he could just stare at the raft box at the pool store of the model who's lying on the raft.
You
stare for hours at the raft box.
Dr. Pinsky, is there any difference really in kind of how America politicizes sexuality compared with other countries?
Absolutely.
And
now,
how?
Now I'm gonna step away from the Trojan Condom Company and talk about my point of view as a physician and as a public health advocate. And yes, in fact, other European countries see youth as an asset. They see media as a partner. They don't perceive young people as a problem. They perceive this as a health issue, not as an ideological issue. And one of the most startling things to me about how we politicize reproductive health is this idea that somehow if we speak about sexuality to young people, we're going to encourage the behavior. I mean, that's a logic that is so flawed, because if you applied that logic to any other behavior, we shouldn't talk about drugs and alcohol, because if we do, they're likely to do that. Sexual behavior is the one behavior that we've decided, if you discuss it with young people, you're going to encourage the behavior.
Maybe we should start reading Wilhelm Reich again.
I know that is.
You know, he's the guy who said that everybody should be educated about sex in their early teens, and that would eliminate neurosis, because repressing sexuality is what causes neurosis.
Well,
he was run out of town, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, I don't want to over or even underestimate the impact that the medical health system has had on taking us off course, because we have contributed to the problems over the years. But the fact is that there is good science about what works for young people, and talking about it, absolutely encouraging abstinence is, of course, everybody that works with young people agrees is the goal, to be faithful, to be honest, and to use condoms, and to be prepared, and to be able to negotiate and assert on yourself on your own behalf. These are all things, building self-esteem, interpersonal experiences, understanding the differences between men and women. These are really, sexual education needs to be seen more of as a social education, as a health issue, not as an ideological, hot potato that everyone can sort of gather around.
Mm-hmm. So we hang on and take some calls with us, Dr. Drew?
That'd be great.
And we'll ask you some more questions. Cool. We'll be back with Dr. Drew Pinsky after this on Air America Radio. Forty-two past the hour, Mark Maron with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott, Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. We've got Dr. Drew on the phone. We want to hear from you. Calls on sex and politics, the politics of sex. What role should politics play in sex? Do you have sex? Do you have any weird sexual questions? I don't mind taking those, and Dr. Drew's a pro, so he can handle it. Right now, the number is 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. Come on, step up. It's sex, for crying out loud. Right now, I've got today's PDB, the Presidential Daily Briefing, the highly classified top secret document that crosses George W. Bush's desk every morning. Today's PDB, maybe you shouldn't have banned research that might have saved Reagan. Mr. President, it has come to our attention that the continued focus on Ronald Reagan's death puts your policies into question and poses an imminent danger to your presidency. Since the late president suffered from Alzheimer's disease, it has brought attention to the role that stem cell research could have had in treating his illness. Unfortunately, as you may or may not recall, you restricted that research. We're still waiting for your memo explaining the reason for that. We do know you hate doctors and have suggested replacing certain medical specialties with the laying on of hands. We're still waiting for the research on that. In the meantime, it might be best to avoid Nancy Reagan at the funeral. She kicked out Clinton, she kicked out Carter, but after days of negotiating with her, we've convinced her not to kick you out. Please don't screw this up for us. Just keep your mouth shut and don't spill anything on the coffin. And don't have any pictures taken next to the body either. Even a dead Reagan looks more presidential than you do. Respectfully, Office of Homeland Security. Tasteful. Very tasty.
Very tasty.
Here come the calls. Did you want to ask Dr. Drew a question before we roll into this?
And I want to give the number again, 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. Dr. Drew Pinsky, I want to get a sense from you about how appointments to public policy organizations impact what these young people do. I have a list in front of me of six different people who've been appointed to different committees of the FDA. And many of them, for example, while in Congress, one of these people, Tom Coburn, tried to force condom manufacturers to label them as ineffective against the spread of sexually transmitted infections. In other words, and there are a lot of people who are, I guess you would call, abstinence freaks that are also on these key committees of the Food and Drug Administration. How does this impact, if at all?
Well, I don't know that I can tell you directly where the impact is. And abstinence, again, is a tremendous goal. Everyone wants that. But most of the abstinence initiatives really are censorship initiatives. They're things that really profoundly restrict what can and cannot be discussed, even when kids have explicit questions. And the idea that somehow suggesting that a condom doesn't help reduce risk is bizarre. And there is, by the way, nothing that is 100.00% effective other than not having sex. And that is like saying, listen, if you drive a car, don't put the seatbelt on because it's not 100% effective. Just don't drive the car. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. And it smacks of people protecting ideologies and not being interested in helping young people. The other thing the FDA has done, which I find astonishing, is the world has available to it the morning after pill, not an abortion pill, a post-coital emergency contraceptive that people get over the counter. There have been hundreds of millions of prescriptions and not a single adverse event. Tylenol and aspirin can't claim that. and it is the best means we have to eliminate abortion in this country. It doesn't let the egg be released, so the sperm never reaches it, so there's no question about it being an abortive pill. It just is taken after intercourse as an emergency measure if something goes wrong. And the FDA, by fiat, decided they're not going to do that in spite of all the scientists recommending in favor of it.
These guys, Dr. Drew Pinsky, you know, it seems to me that these guys are creating a sort of environment of repression and fear. I mean, there's really no way to expect teenagers to, you know, abstain completely. It seems ridiculous to me.
Well, to create a environment or a sort of an attitude of normative being abstinence is the goal.
Right.
But to restrict access to information that's going to significantly protect their health, improve their health, doesn't make sense. Again, it's like saying, let's not talk about drugs and alcohol, because if we talk about it, well, that's just encouraging them to do that.
Let's take some calls. Susan in New York. How are you, Susan?
Hi.
Hi.
I want to tell you that I love you guys. I love your show. I love your station. And Dr. Drew, I love you too.
Well, Susan, you've done so much for everybody this morning. It's great.
So very what's good. Going on, Susan?
I am dating a guy who can't have an orgasm when he wears a condom.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And he can't have an orgasm from oral sex.
Wow.
Yeah.
Or from my hand.
Hmm. I can't. You know what? This
get
guy,
rid of him.
He's a Martian.
He is worse than most I've dated, and I've noticed that most guys who can't have an orgasm with a condom on, it's because they need a bigger condom. I got this guy the biggest condom I could find.
Okay, well, thanks, Susan.
Here's the deal. Here's the basic solution to that, and it's very simple. I would suggest, you know, listen, first of all, Trojan makes a thing called Magnum XL, which is actually their bigger condom. The Magnum is not a bigger condom.
I wear them as booties in the rain sometimes.
Yeah.
They're my favorites, personally.
And that's about right. You certainly wouldn't wear them for anything else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the Magnum XL is available. There are other things, again, the Trojan people are trying to do to encourage the feel of the experience.
Right.
There's something that has a warming sensation on both sides of the condom. They can go to TrojanCondomsPlural.com and look at these various brands and try them. And the other thing is try them. This guy needs to begin putting them on and using them regularly as a way of getting used to it. It's too important an issue not to find a solution to this. And it's not an uncommon problem, but just throw up your hands and go, oh, I can't do this.
Okay.
Doctor, you stay in touch with the Trojan people, right?
Yeah.
I got a good idea for you.
They're open to it. Let's hear it.
Free music downloads. With each 10 condoms bought or with each package, they get a free music download.
Okay.
All right, here's the number, 866-303-2270.
Does it have to be Barry White music?
Yeah.
it's interesting how the whole tone of the show, how quickly it could become just a sex call-in show. I love this. Okay, here we go. Alex in Chicago. Alex for Dr. Drew.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi.
Love your show. I work in the HIV field. I'm an adherence counselor. And
great.
I just wanted to more of a comment. There's a lot of misinformation that I find out there on the effectiveness of condoms against the spread of HIV in particular. And I just wanted Dr. Drew, if you could comment on that, about how effective condoms are against the spread of HIV.
Well, I know my position. Let's hear your guys.
General?
Is he still there?
Yeah, Alex, he's still there? Yeah.
What is your position on that?
The best research we have from UNAIDS is in studies with serodiscordant couples, one person who is HIV positive and one person who's not, and they consistently and correctly use condoms, there has been no transmission of HIV between the two people.
That's right. The people that have relatively low levels of circulating virus, if you use a safer sex method, the probability of transmission is remote. Yeah. It is not as though it's a highly contagious disease that unless you have a perfectly effective means of preventing transmission, you're going to infect somebody.
Just really quickly, Doctor.
What's that?
Sorry, just really quickly, Drew Pinsky. That the thing that I feel quite strongly about is that this going on and on about abstinence is that why the government can't have some kind of initiative to talk about communication. Why sex has to be this physical thing, why it's not really about emotions. They seem to totally miss the point on that over and over again.
And your point about other countries not missing the point is well taken, that it's something that's seen as part of, again, a general health initiative. How do you get people, how do you teach people about the interpersonal experience? You forget you're talking about sex after a while because that isn't the headline. The headline is, who am I in an interpersonal context? How do I get my needs met? Where does sex fit into that? this is a very complex issue. And in our country right now, when most people come out of destroyed family systems, it's very difficult to get them to look at sex and relationship as anything other than another bromide, another drug, another source of arousal to help them manage their feelings, rather than something that's specifically important to be addressed as a separate issue.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Drew Pinsky. Really appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
Wow, he's a very bright guy. Very bright guy. We'll be back with Recovery Corner, and I think maybe William from Chappaqua might be calling here on Air America Radio. Morning's edition, Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott, here on Air America Radio. I am Mark, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
And in Recovery Corner, I reach out to fellow 12-steppers who are struggling today to stay clean and sober today, as always. Often reaching out to my sponsor, George W. George W., this could be a good day for you. I mean, after today's session of the G8 Summit, you know that everyone's going to go, they're going to be breaking off into cliques. The French are going to go to the wine bars. The Germans head for the beer halls. The Russians, go-kart racing. For some reason, they're fascinated with it. Vodka and go-karts, not a good combination. So where does that leave you, George? Well, it turns out you end up with the Muslim leaders. That's right. Your worst enemies can be your best friends this week. They can't drink. You can't drink. Finally, common ground. Maybe that's why you hung around the Bin Laden family so much. In any case, this step on your road to recovery could inadvertently open the door to world peace. So take the Arabs to Jamba Juice Bar. They're from the desert. They're probably thirsty. But don't suggest a meeting. It's about attraction, not promotion. Remember, keep the plug in the jug. There's no chemical solution to a spiritual problem. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Practice an attitude of gratitude. Change is a process, not an event. Fear is the darkroom where negatives are developed. Don't drink. Get to a meeting. So what do you got over there, Riley?
Well, I don't know how best to describe it, but, former President Reagan's funeral is coming up on Friday, and they've brought in people from throughout the free world to speak, to eulogize the 40th president of the United States. But one who has not been invited, one who has been snubbed, is another former president of the United States, one William Jefferson Clinton.
Aww.
And word is, he's more than a little upset. Being snubbed.
Usually he's listening, and right when he hears us mention his name, he gets, there he is, William from Chappaqua, on the phone. What's up? How are you? How are you, President Clinton?
I'm all right.
What's the matter, buddy?
Well, this is an important national event. It's a bipartisan event in nature, and both parties should be represented. The nature of an event like this when we all come together as a whole.
Yeah, so you're feeling, rejected, angry? We just had Dr. Drew on. You could have talked to him.
Yeah, it's just an unfortunate turn of events.
Oh, wait, there's Bill from Harlem. Hey, Bill.
Hey, guys.
What's going on, man?
I'm laughing, but I'm mad.
Yeah. What's the matter? You feel dissed? You feel snuffed?
Well, of course. Nothing tugs at my heartstrings like seeing thousands of lovely young ladies crying and sad. And then who are they going to turn to for a little TLC? Right here, right. Baby.
The pain feeler.
Man. I'll sprinkle it with love, make your world taste good. That's all I mean. So, I feel your pain.
Yeah. So are you going to try and maybe bully your way to the pulpit and lay it out?
Well, I might, but there's nothing like 1,000 ladies in black camisoles, black push-up bras, tiny black G-strings. Oh, it may be morning in America, but it's playtime for Elvis. Oh, my goodness.
How do you feel?
I can talk about that all day.
How do you feel about the passing of Ronald Reagan, really?
Well, I think he was a wonderful man. I think he missed a lot of opportunities in the White House, you know what I'm saying? I went through that place like a hot knife through butter.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm glad to see that you're feeling the grief.
I got one last thing. I have a patriotic duty to the booty.
I think one of them will find a way to go.
Yeah, I think so. Feeling the pain.
Morning seditions coming into the home stretch. We've got the presidential palm pilot, the countdown to democracy, and tighter security on the rails and in the air this summer. Don't go away. This is Air America Radio.
Hey, I'm Mark Maron with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, Wednesday, day three in Dead Reagan Week. We'll talk today with the author of A Pretext for War, which is about how pre-war intelligence spurred the onset of the Iraq conflict. We'll make up the contents of the president's Palm Pilot for today. That's coming up. Of course, right now I'm joined by the recovering Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley.
Good morning,
good
everybody.
Morning.
Good morning. She looks recovered. She's eating up them blueberries.
Yeah, she seems to be
I'm just
doing
leaving all these nasty, mushy, bad ones at the bottom of the box.
Uh-oh.
Quite well. You know, out of respect for Reagan, you know, I know he's dead, and I respect that. But there is a group
you
of people.
What? Say that again.
I respect that he's dead.
I think
dead.
I'm going to relapse.
Oh, okay.
I respect that he's dead. I mean, I know. I mean, he's dead. He's dead. And, you know, he's still dead, and this is day three in the ongoing celebration. Or no, you don't call it celebration of grieving.
Commemoration.
But there's a group, right? There's a group of people called the Reagan Legacy Project that they've taken it upon themselves. All they do, you know, 20, you know, 5 days a week, you know, every day, all day long, is think about how the Reagan legacy can be honored. These are the guys who a few months ago said we want to put Reagan on the dime, which I saw as a symbolic revisionary, is that a word? Revisionary gesture to erase the legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who put together the New Deal, Social Security, all the things that, you know, radical conservatives hate because they might help people. See, it was Reagan who first blamed the poor for being poor. And he said that in order to not be poor, you just got to, you know, pull yourself together a little bit. Now, the Reagan Legacy Project now wants to, you know, put Reagan on the $10 bill or on some money. You know, they've got a whole list of things that they want to do. And we've got a few ideas for them. That we'd like to share with them. So if you're listening out there, this is for the Reagan Legacy Project. Maybe one. How about the Reagan Stem Cell Research Institute in Helsinki? How would that be?
Oh, yeah.
How about this? Putting his picture on our money, specifically the $1,000 bill. That way it will be spent by the people who benefited most from his policies. How about that? How about rename the Reagan International Airport to Reagan International Airport? Again. You know, just again to have another ceremony. How about name all other airports the Reagan International Airport? This will honor Reagan and confuse terrorists. How about put his face on Mount Rushmore? Maybe remove Jefferson. How about that? How about when people sneeze, instead of saying, God bless you, you say, Ronald Reagan was a great president. Do you agree? That would go like this. Ronald Reagan was a good president. Do you agree? Thank you. On the currency, changing God we trust you. There you go again. How about this? Swap so that Reagan has a memorial in Washington, D.C., and Abraham Lincoln has star on Hollywood Boulevard. That seems reasonable. How about that? How about for Christmas, special red, white, and blue cheese Reagan log? You know, with the nuts on it. Nice. These are just some ideas.
I just want to mention this great school librarian I met yesterday who, at a public school in
Where were you?
I was listening on the Reagan stuff.
But were you visiting schools yesterday?
I was visiting a school.
Oh, okay.
Where was I kind of mentally?
Okay. No.
Okay.
Physically.
Like, why were you? Oh, because you're
kidding. I'm visiting schools right now to try and work out which school I'm going to put my children in. But anyway, so I was at a school, and yeah, everybody's under pressure to revere Ronald Reagan this week, and she'd put out this Ronald Reagan books inside the library, because I guess they could have had to for appearances' sake. But on the top, she'd put her union cap.
Wow.
Which I thought was a nice gesture.
Well, he was a union guy. I mean, he was the president of SAG.
Yeah, but they, you know, the kind of busting of the airline unions.
Yeah.
I mean, he's sort of very remembered for that. He's not remembered, I don't think, by school teachers and members of unions as exactly a pro-union guy in his later days, in his presidency, for sure.
He's remembered by unions as being a union buster. He's remembered by poor people as being an ass.
Yeah, that would be just about it. Now, Dana Rohrabacher wants Ronald Reagan on a $20 bill. He wants to replace Andrew Jackson.
On a $20
bill? On a $20 bill. And there's also talk about replacing John F. Kennedy, a recent icon, on a half dollar.
Oh, come on.
I don't know anybody uses half dollars.
I think these guys, they were like, why don't we just start the calendar over when the Berlin Wall came down? Why don't we do that?
Why don't they overhaul the whole money system and stop it all being green in the same size?
And didn't somebody actually seriously float a proposal to put his face on Mount Rushmore? I mean, I know we were joking about it earlier, but
no, you're
right. Somebody seriously
I think it was him.
Yeah, it might have been.
It was Reagan?
I read about that.
I think I'd look
No, he did. He made a joke about that.
I didn't know I had a Reagan impression in me. It was kind of halfway there.
Well, it was kind of halfway there, you know.
I'll check into that. I think it was Reagan who made a joke about Mount Rushmore.
Well, you know, there may be people who might seriously. I mean, they are trying to deify this guy. And to me, The ultimate irony of Ronald Reagan is the fact that the federal building in Washington that bears his name has more – this is the big tax cutter, the man who shrank government.
Yeah.
It's got more federal employees than any other building in Washington.
I met him in Washington.
Really?
Yeah, when I was a Cub reporter.
Uh-oh.
Covering Iran-Contra, and he had to make a press conference. Everybody was scrambling, you know, Sam Donaldson, all the TVs, everything else, and he came out on the steps of some building up on Capitol Hill, and I'd gone on there with my bicycle. Because I used to cycle everywhere.
Pre-scooter.
Yeah, my pre-scooter days and the bicycle. And I have my helmet under my arm and one of those sort of fluorescent stripes that your mothers put you in England so you don't get run over in the fog. And of all the people, he looked at this clearly inept of 20-year-old out on the steps among all the real pros and pointed to me to ask the question.
Yeah,
so, you know what?
Did you pull it off?
I pulled it off in a kind of like stammering kind of hopeless way.
What was your
question? I don't know. God knows. It's so long ago. Were you guilty? Did you know?
No, sorry, I'm 20.
It's important to note, too, by the way, that FDR is on the dime because he was one of the people who spearheaded the March of Dimes.
Uh-huh.
Because, of course, he had polio.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of people, he hid it through a lot of
his
presence.
Yeah, he hid it for a very, very long time. But, you know, you can, I think, revere someone. You can recognize someone's work if you want or whatever, but you don't change everything for Ronald Reagan. My God.
You know
but this is definitely a push, man. It's a push by the Republicans to, and they say they're not politicizing it. It's one thing to have a country of grief. I mean, Reagan obviously was very successful at, you know, at convincing a large amount of people that everything was okay for a really long time. I mean, you know, it wasn't okay, and there was a lot of bad things going on, but the reason people love him is they believed him, and they, you know, his optimism made them feel like they weren't part of the horrendous evil that his administration was committing under a cloak of darkness. So that was his great contribution. I mean, there are arguments even that, you know, that he, you know, that the timing of the collapse of communism, you know, that was happening slowly for 40 years, and that, you know,
it was happening anyway. It would have happened no matter who was president. But why is it that there are the two living Democratic presidents, if this is all so nonpartisan, if it's all such a Ronald Reagan love fest, why are Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter snubbed?
Because it's absolutely not that, because it's clearly very, very political.
Oh, yeah, they're trying to capture the national mind and make it Republican for as long as they can, all of them. You know, and as we've seen, many of our listeners are just furious by this postmortem stroke fest.
It's all about TV. This morning I was looking at people trooping past the coffin on CNN, and there was a camera right on this, several people, a mother and a son and these guys, and they were just, one of them was just walking past, and then out of the corner of his eye, he saw the camera was on him, and then he kind of took a step back and did this salute. And looked at everybody. And I think that's what the whole country finds itself doing. It's as if everybody finds themselves in a bigger version of that, you know, mentally walking past the coffin and realizing there's a camera on them and then stepping back and making a salute. We all fall victim to that.
I don't know.
You, Mark Maron.
I got to tell you, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful here. I respect all American presidents. I'm an American. But I'll be glad when Friday's over.
Well, you know, you just turn off the TV. But you can. I mean, unaffected by it all. You don't have to be sucked into it.
Well, but see, to an extent, you end up getting sucked in.
Really?
One way or the other.
Get a scooter.
But you're not an American.
Exactly. That helps.
You know, I mean, the bottom line is there are references virtually everywhere you look. And again, you know,
but I would feel the same about Thatcher. I felt the same about the royal wedding, for heaven's sake. I just didn't watch it. You know, everybody gets sucked into these kind of
weird
big events and media hype. You just have to just steel yourself and step away. It's very easy not to get involved.
I talked to some cats, you know, last night. I did Colin Quinn's show. And these are dudes that, you know, comics that, you know, will say anything about anybody,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, there's an argument, you know, to be had with some of them that, you know, how is it, do you have to wait? You know, and I was pretty surprised because some of these cats were like, you know, they were like, you might want to wait a couple of days, you know.
Yeah.
And these are tasteless guys, some of these guys, in terms of the type of humor they
But it was Ronald Reagan,
they take
man.
Chances. Well, they weren't quite like that. They were just, one guy said, you guys are mean. Liberals are mean. And I said, you know what? If Clinton died, you're going to tell me that Rush Limbaugh or any of those other guys, I'm not using them as a barometer, but they would have been all over it. They would have, you know, they would have been making fun of them before the corpse was even, you know, cold.
Yeah.
So we'll be back with the liberal agenda with author James Bamford and other stuff. Talk about the 9/11 Commission.
Yeah.
Okay. Air America, come on back. 19 past the hour. Good morning. God bless America. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. It is now time for me to read what my buddy from the Oval Office sent me. He hacked into the presidential palm pilot. Here's the presidential schedule for today. 8 a.m., wake up, stay on message. G8 stands for great. 8:30 a.m., wear big cowboy hat just to show there's a new sheriff in town. 10 a.m., hand over keys to pay off golfing bet to Saudi Arabian King Al Saud. Tell Shane you'll have to find another limo. 1 p.m., use Joy Buzzer on Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin to reassert your dominance over Canada. 3 p.m., get down to business. Demand golf rematch to win back Cheney's limo. 5 p.m., as part of the economic recovery plan, enlist world leaders in pyramid scheme. Isn't that what the UN resolution is? I think. All right. 7 p.m., tell Tony Blair if you're really with us, you'll get matching tattoos with me. 9 p.m., work on friendship books to give world leaders tomorrow. 10 p.m., lights out. Hide under covers, making nightly prank call to Michael Moore. That's it. That's it. We got a guest coming up, but Riley, let's lay down some groundwork. Lay down some pipes.
The 9/11 panel is finishing up its work, and its final report isn't due until July 26th. However, some portions of the report are already drafted and already in the hands of media, and it's not pretty in its criticism of both the CIA and the FBI. The AP describes it as stinging, and some commissioners say there's a consensus that changes are needed. However, the report avoids assigning any specific individual blame to avoid the perception of partisanship. 9/11 Commissioner John Lehman pointed at restrictions put on the FBI in the wake of the 30-year-old Watergate scandal as one of the biggest obstacles to terror prevention. So 30-year-old restrictions equals no terror intelligence. The commission holds its final public hearing next week, and members say they are hopeful of releasing a unanimous report, but that's not guaranteed. There may be some sidebars from some of the commissioners who don't agree with some of the main conclusions.
Wow. It's amazing that they're saying that stuff that comes out of the, you know, Watergate is responsible for the failure of communication between terrorists, intelligence agencies now.
I wonder what those restrictions are. Maybe we can ask our guests. In the wake of Tenet's resignation and controversies involving Ahmed Chalabi, this new book, a timely new book, is on bookstands this week. A Pretext for War by James Bamford examines how pre-war intelligence spurred the onset of war with Iraq and reveals new details about the lead-up and aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. James Bamford joins us now on the phone from Washington, D.C. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Mark.
So tell me, like, were the CIA, were those fellows, were they bullied by these neocons? You know, why'd they buckle? How come they're so weak?
Well, that's exactly what they did. They buckled. You can see it in the actions of George Tenet, basically, in the lead-up to the war. In the period going up to about October of 2002, he was bucking the administration to a large degree. He was telling the National Security Council that they should take out of the president's speech in Cincinnati, his speech to the nation on Iraq.
Right.
They should take out the reference to Saddam buying uranium from Africa. And they reluctantly agreed to do that. But then right after that, it seems like either Tenet got a call or he got a notice from somebody at the White House that he's not a team member, and from then on he became a team member. And
so he got a horse's head in his bed?
Exactly, yeah, because you can't see anything more dramatic about it than the President's State of the Union, when not only did the reference go back in, the reference to the Saddam getting uranium from Africa, but George Tenet, the Director of Central Intelligence, never even bothered to read the President's State of the Union address before he gave it.
So you think they were setting him up all the way back then?
Well, I think he was the odd man out. He was the only holdover from the Clinton administration. He was the only sort of neocon, only person who wasn't a real onboard neocon, and I think they gave him a message. Either you play on our team or you go someplace else, and he didn't want to go someplace else.
Mm-hmm. James Bamford, I'm curious. There seems to be some reporting that says, of course, there's the CIA, there's the DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency, and then there are reports that there was actually a third channel in the run-up to the war that Donald Rumsfeld used and got information primarily from Ahmad Chalabi and members of the Iraqi National Congress. Talk a bit about how that impacted on Bush's thinking.
Well, that's right. The problem here is that the CIA was set up many years ago in the late 40s to be an independent channel of information to the White House on intelligence. It's supposed to take a look at it objectively without any partisan influence one way or the other. And that's where the president is supposed to get his intelligence, from this impartial body known as the Central Intelligence Agency. But the problem was the CIA wasn't really on board on this war in Iraq from the very beginning. It wasn't coming up with the evidence that the White House wanted and that the Pentagon wanted. It wasn't coming up with the hard evidence of weapons of mass destruction, the connection with al-Qaeda, and so forth. So basically the White House began ignoring the CIA and began getting most of its intelligence from the Pentagon. And this was the home of the neoconservatives. Wolfowitz, Fife, Wilmser was there at the time. And all these people were feeding information that was coming from people like Chalabi and Chalabi's defectors. And they were cherry-picking little items that were taken out of context from from other sources. So you have the CIA coming up with fairly good information, saying that we don't see any real evidence of weapons of mass destruction or links to al-Qaeda, and that was being ignored in favor of the information coming from the defectors giving up false information to the White House from Ahmed Chalabi.
James Bamford, in your book, A Pretext for War, you write about how pre-war intelligence drove the Bush administration into the confrontation with Iraq. How do you feel about the reforms people are talking about with the various intelligence agencies? You know, what should the United States do? Which country does have the best spy agency? You know, whom should we be modeling U.S. intelligence services on?
Well, the structure that is always sort of created, there's been about every two or three years is a commission to look into the reorganization of the intelligence community. It goes back decades. And virtually every single one comes up with the same scheme to some degree, and that's putting a person in charge of the entire intelligence community and then making him in charge, fully in charge of all U.S. spying activity.
Are you in favor of that?
I think it's probably a good concept. I think it's certainly a lot better than the one we have right now. And that's the one that actually, when Bush came into office, he asked Brett Scowcroft, who was his chairman of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, to come up with a an idea for reorganizing the intelligence community, and that's what he came up with. But the problem is every single time somebody comes up with an idea like that, whoever happens to be Secretary of Defense rejects it, because the Secretary of Defense, as few people really realize, controls 85% of all the intelligence, not the Director of Central Intelligence, and that's why the Secretary of Defense has always objected to this, because it would take away so much power.
So, James Bamford, quickly, you know, what drove us to war, the intelligence or the neocons trumping up the intelligence?
Well, certainly it was the neocons. The intelligence, there was never any real intelligence that we had any weapons of mass destruction over there.
Now they're trying to wash their hands of it.
I'm sorry?
They're trying to wash their hands of anyone who was connected with this, what they would call faulty intelligence.
Well, the faulty intelligence was generated about 90% from the Pentagon, and it was generated enormously. They were coming up with all kinds of wacko scenarios of connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, these meetings in Prague and so forth. It was all nonsense.
Well, we got to go. Thank you so much. Very informative. James Bamford, the book is A Pretext for War.
Wow, some scary stuff in there. Huh?
Unbelievable.
Coming up, the liberal agenda, the countdown to democracy, countdown to democracy, and you on the phones. This is Air America Radio.
Good morning. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. It's Air America Radio, and it's time to get ready for the summer of fear.
Woo!
We remember the summer of love, but right, Riley, it's the summer of fear this year.
Coming up.
The summer. Guess what? Be scared. Bad things are going to happen. Have a good vacation.
Well, they're talking about 334 million people on the roads, on the rails, in the skies this summer. That's more than 2001 by about 23 million. But security improvements, not really. You know, the Transportation Security Administration.
Aren't they cutting that?
They're talking about cutting it, but then, you know, they're also talking, they're trying, I think, to save themselves by saying now they're going to step up security on the trains. In fact, they're going to be inspecting baggage on many of the passenger Amtrak's long-distance travelers out of Washington, D.C., out of Union Station.
Subways?
They've been doing that for a while.
Really?
Yeah, they started that.
When?
They were screening bags when I was on Amtrak back, you know, a couple of weeks ago.
Really? Because they say here, well, actually, maybe it was a couple of weeks. Because I know the last time I went down to D.C., they weren't screening anything.
Dude, otherwise, I was on the subway. I had to panic.
I mean, it could have been a special thing because it was, you know, a big event or something. But I thought that they, you know, that is it not? There's a pilot program, right?
Yeah, this is part of a pilot program. This is a TSA pilot program, and since they're, you know, I guess since they're jeopardized, and they're dealing with Amtrak, which probably loses more money than them. They figured they might as well justify their existence by screening bags on the rails.
You know what it was? I could have been on one of the trains where they started it, and now they're extending the program over for all trains.
Yeah. Well, this will only last till June 30th, as it turns out. But there's a lot of fear, at least among administration officials, that something will happen during the course of this summer because there are going to be so many people out.
I'm afraid. I'm already afraid, man. I was on the subway yesterday. I had the subway fear. Guy with a big old bag.
Yeah.
Had a sort of despondent, angry look in his eye. I literally, I hate to admit this, but I checked to see if he was holding a detonator, and I went to another car. That's the weird thing is, like, I wasn't afraid enough to get off the train, you know what I mean? Well, I'll go to the next car. That way, what's the worst that could happen? It'll be noisy. But the truth of the matter is, what this implies to me is that Bush is creating and encouraging an environment of fear, which means that, you know, we really aren't any safer, and the numbers prove it. I mean, strategically speaking, I mean, the numbers of, you know, of fatal attacks by al-Qaeda in the 4 years prior to September 11th, 8 attacks, 349 fatalities, 7 nations. In the 3 years after September 11th, not counting attacks in Afghanistan and Iraq, 14 attacks, 599 fatalities, 10 nations. Now, this, in a new poll, you know, Bush, his approval ratings are low in everything. The overall, 49%. Kerry beat him in these new polls.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in almost everything, the economy, foreign affairs, Iraq, energy, prescription drugs, all everyone disapproves of him. But in terrorism, 56% approve. Why aren't these people able to make the connection that he is the guy fanning the flames of fear? I mean, there's a difference between taking precautions and creating an environment of fear.
Absolutely.
Which makes people, you know, crave to be guided, even if the person guiding them is, in some respects, helping the terrorists.
Completely. It has a big knockdown effect to everything you do in your lives. It's not just, you know, it's just travel. You know that the other week that I went to that Harry Potter premiere at Radio City because my husband worked on the movie, everybody's bags were screened. There were 6,000 seats at that place, and there, you know, there's a massive security, guards everywhere, your bags were screened, cameras were confiscated, and then given back at the end of the performance. I went to the London premiere the following week, Leicester Square, huge theatre, masses of crowds, no security whatsoever. You basically show your ticket, you walk past, we go, oh, yes, okay, very nice, thank you, off you go. And you walk through the door, same movie stars, same celebrities, same concentration of people, middle of a big city, completely different attitude. And people absorb that. People absorb that fear. Here, Americans are very used to being screened.
It's like people in Israel are used to having people, armed people on the streets. I don't know how we, you know, deal with this problem. If the fear, you know, obviously there is a threat. But, I mean, it's like it should be clear that this president has not effectively followed through with his promises, nor is he representing himself correctly.
Well, here's a question for you.
Okay.
You walk across the streets of New York City.
Yeah.
And you see National Guards people, like at Penn Station or at the bus terminal or some of these other places where the transportation hubs, that sort of thing.
Right.
Do you feel more afraid or do you feel safer?
Usually what happens to me immediately is I feel like seeing what's going on.
He's the wrong person to ask.
I mean, I know what you're saying, and maybe I'm sliding away. I go into a state of like, you know, is there something immediately going on. I'm not used to it. I think more afraid.
Really? I kind of go into that. I roll my eyes and think, well, at least people are being employed.
Well, I'm wondering.
Do you really, Sue?
I do.
I'm wondering. So you wait. You see National Guardsmen on the street with guns, and you just say, "Oh, that's good that the National Guard is."
No, I don't think it's good. I kind of in a kind of like, "Oh God, not that kind of way." No, I don't feel that's great that they're there. I feel, oh, what a load of hype, and I think it's unpleasant to have to see that. I do believe that people need to be taken care of, that there has to be some degree of security.
But you're that jaded.
I think a lot of it is kind of cosmetic.
All right, so you don't experience any fear. You're that jaded. It doesn't even apply. It doesn't even. You don't even for 1 second go, "What's happening?"
No, I don't feel. I really don't feel fearful. And then you can argue that I'm kind of naive or stupid, and
jaded,
I have kids, I have a family.
Jaded.
We're jaded. It's just that I'm just not. I just feel really unwilling to be intimidated and to allow that to influence.
See,
if they came running at you with the guns and said, "Get out of the way," then you'd say, "Wait, you guys, I think that you're overreacting."
Well, isn't that? That is how I speak.
No, I mean, look, I think that a lot of this stuff happens. I mean, in the immediate wake of September 11th, people used to say, "Hey, it's great that they're stopping these trucks and searching them, because it makes people feel like something, anything,
yeah,
even
but
if
then
it's
stop
not affecting
every truck.
Are you afraid?
Stop a
random Are you afraid? 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. How you feeling? Scared? Not scared? Safe? Is it hype? What? Call us. We want to know if you've seen any security measures in your town since September 11th. We're taking calls 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. Hard for New York to take the security measures necessary, because we're only allocated as much money as every other city in the United States because of the way it's designed, the allocation is designed. We'll get back to that in a minute. Right now, countdown to democracy. As the deadline for handover of power to the Iraqis approaches, we'd like to explore various issues and opportunities Iraqis and Americans will face. Today's issue is the UN isn't so big. Leaders of Iraq, we know the UN passed a resolution giving you sovereignty. This might make you think you're answering to the UN and not us. Believe me, the UN is us. If we didn't want that resolution passed, we could have brought back Saddam Hussein as a clone. You don't think we have power in the UN? Guess where its headquarters are? I'll give you a hint. I'm looking at it out the window of our studio right now. So if you have a problem, you can either argue with us or you can argue with the UN, which is basically like arguing with us and everybody else, but mainly us. As to your own position in the UN, well, you'll be sitting at the kids' table for a while. And if you act up, it's not hard to move you into the corridor. Good luck and God bless. This is day 21 in our countdown to democracy. Live free or die.
Oh, yeah.
Mark Riley, hot news.
Yeah, well, before we go to the phones, you know, we were talking earlier this morning about the Kurds. And I've long said, when it comes to the occupation and, quote, rebuilding of Iraq, watch out for the Kurds. Well, the Kurds now say both parties of the Kurds, because there are two major political parties, they say they may bolt this new government if the Shiites become too powerful. The Shiites and the Kurds appear to be feuding over a reference to the interim constitution. The interim constitution makes reference to Kurdish federalism, not nationhood, but Kurdish federalism. And they wanted that included in the resolution. The U.S. and the British turned them down cold. That may have been because the most prominent Shiite leader, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, said he would not accept mention of that interim charter in the resolution, because the Shiites don't want the Kurds to have veto power over a permanent constitution drawn up next year.
Wow.
Feeling double-crossed.
When Sistani speaks.
They were the only people who pretty much did come close to waving flowers and celebrating being liberated.
Won't get fooled again.
They were the most positive toward the U.S. coalition of anybody in Iraq.
Yep.
866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270, sedition at airamerica.com. Radio.com. We're taking your calls about security, fear. Judith, Maryland, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Hey.
So you live near Andrews Air Force Base?
Yes. I live a couple blocks from Andrews Air Force Base. And between all the media and closing down our road, we won't be able to get out of here all day long.
For the funeral?
Yes, for the funeral.
You feel safe?
Up here, right at the... a few months ago at the base. We have a huge water tower, and it was always just this big, gray, ugly thing. Now it has Andrews Air Force Base put on it, so it's like we feel like there's a main target here now.
Right.
If you didn't know where the president's plane was, you do now.
Right.
But never mind that. What about us?
Right. So you don't feel any safer, really.
Heck no.
Thank you, Judith, for calling. Great call. Rob, Manhattan, how are you?
What's up, Rob?
Rob.
Oh, Rob.
Rob.
Going once?
Hello.
Hey, what's up, man?
Hey, this is Chuck. I'm not Rob.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chuck. My
not
mistake.
Chuck Rob either.
No problem. Hey, guys, I want to thank you for Air America Radio. You're wonderful.
Thank you.
I live in New York, and I wanted to say something about security, like a Grand Central Terminal.
Uh-huh.
Sure, there's National Guard there with rifles, but they're girl watching. They're not professional. They're not paying attention. It's really a joke.
So if they were paying attention, how would you feel?
I would feel better if they were paying attention. Right now, it's a big nothing.
Okay. Thank you very much for your
call. That's interesting because some of them also have dogs, you know. And see, it's interesting because, you know, the Port Authority police also have dogs, and some of the National Guardsmen have dogs.
You know what the dogs are doing?
Well, some of them are supposed to be for drugs, some of them are supposed to be for bombs, I guess. I hope.
You made it funny.
What?
You know what the dogs are doing? Bitch watching.
Oh.
All right, Rob in Manhattan. Rob, how are you?
We good. How you doing?
Okay, hey, man, what's on your mind?
I got a dog.
Hey, I feel safe already.
Yeah, he's a good dog. He just barks too much.
Uh-huh.
So what do you feel safe or what's on your mind?
No, I think it's a joke. These guys I got at the tunnel, these poor guys have got to breathe these fumes in and day out, pretending like they're doing anything, you know, protecting the city.
Yeah.
At the bridges and tunnels. I mean, it's a really disgrace for these guys to have to stand there, pick and choose a truck like it's going to stop anything. Meanwhile, a bus just drives right through. They don't say anything to a bus.
Rob, you know, you've hit on something because I used to come in by bus every morning. And in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the first thing I thought of was, okay, well, they used a plane before. Now they'll use a bus because nobody checks buses. People just get on the commuter buses. People get on. People bring whatever they want. And nobody checks anything.
So he sort of agrees with you. It's sort of a hype deterrent.
It is. I mean, it's annoying when you go off to LAX airport and, you know, there's all this security there and they, you know, they let you just drive straight through and then they stop some guy at random. I think either stop everybody or have some kind of sensible security. I don't know what you can do, but something that seems to make some kind of sense.
You don't think that, like, maybe on that line there's a guy in a car with a bomb in the trunk saying, damn, not our day, turns around, goes away? You don't think that's a possibility?
Probably not. But you know where else? And security is even worse when it comes to the ports, okay? Like the Port of Newark.
Oh, they can't even get that under control.
Yeah,
no way. You see how many containers are
in
there?
I know. Well, they just had a thing last year. One of the newspapers here smuggled some kind of depleted uranium from ABC News, from Indonesia to the Port of Los Angeles. It was never screened once.
Yeah, you know, if there weren't so many tax cuts to the rich, maybe some of this money could have been re-put into where it belongs to secure our cities. Clarence in St. Louis, how are you?
Hey.
Clarence.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just want to say I'm very afraid, you know, what's going on with this administration.
Yeah.
And I just want to know, what did you think? If I could sue the administration for my anxiety.
Stress. Pain and suffering.
Thanks for the call.
Pain and suffering.
Thanks a lot, Clarence. Yeah, maybe he can get on that new rigged Medicare, that medical plan where he can get some anti-anxiety medication paid for by the government, except it doesn't work that way.
Maybe Judge Mathis or Judge Joe Brown might have awarded him a couple of dollars.
It's an interesting question. Like, you know, if he's going to keep scaring the hell out of everybody, when will the government start handing out Xanax for everyone?
Well, here's something really quickly. A survey by the financial advisory firm U.S. Trust, quoted in today's Wall Street Journal, the single biggest worry of wealthy Americans today is the potential negative effect of terrorism on the economy. Okay? So other people have bigger things in their lives.
You mean it's not black
on.
People anymore?
Well, it's, you know, rich people who are worried about what's going to happen if there's a terrorist attack. I mean, the richest people are the most worried. Okay. Other people are still worried about how to get a job and get benefits.
We're going to keep your calls coming in, so stay on the line, you guys. 866-303-AAR0. A lot of excitement on the phone lines about security. Are you safer? Do you feel safer? What's going on in your world? Come back to Air America Radio. Let's land this thing. It's Mark Maron on Morning's Edition with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott, and Air America Radio. Still taking calls at 866-303-2270 about how you feel, safe, not safe, frightened, more frightened, what's on your mind. We have got Gabe in Massachusetts. Gabe, how are you?
Hey, pretty good.
Good,
hey.
Man. What's on your mind?
So I took an airplane ride last weekend, and I'm in the process of changing my name.
Yeah.
And so my ID didn't actually match the my plane ticket was for.
Right.
So I ended up at the airport. I didn't really remember. I mean, I didn't remember at all. I got to the airport, and all of a sudden.
That must have been a bad moment when you're like, oh, man.
I was like,
oh,
yeah, absolutely. I was quite, I mean, I wasn't nervous. I was a little nervous. I was like, oh, geez, I don't want, I mean, I got tattoos. I get put into customs all the time, and I always get questioned, and, you know, and there's tons of security. There's dogs everywhere. I'm like, ah, oh, Jesus, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah.
And people are taking off their shoes. It was the first time I've flown in a really long time.
So what happened?
Their shoes and everything. Well, they looked at my ID, they looked at my ticket, and they let me right on through.
Oh, that was good. At least they didn't deport you.
Well, you're making me scared to death to actually go through the security and everything. You don't even catch it. I mean, thank you very much for not catching it.
Yeah, it doesn't. It just goes to show you we're really no safer. Thanks for your call.
That's what I told you. My 5-year-old was banned from flying into America, 2 months ago. And then when I got back to the embassy, it turned out they'd let him come in illegally on the same passport in December.
By the way,
completely inconsistent.
You know, they did deport a U.S. citizen not long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, an actual U.S. citizen, in case of mistaken identity, they had the same first and last name. They deported him, I believe, to Guyana. They deported him down to the Caribbean because they thought he was somebody else. And then he was spending all his time in Guyana trying to get back to the States. I'm not the guy you're thinking I am.
Oh, what a drag.
Unbelievable.
Hey, can we get Chris in Manhattan? Chris, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good. What's up?
What's up? Well, when I go into Union Square subway station and I see all those camouflage guys carrying those M16s, I just wonder if the attack they're expecting is going to be machine guns and terrorists with machine guns drawn, you know? And,
right.
You're right.
Then
I'm
wondering what's going to happen when all those M16s start firing down the subway station there.
Thanks for your call. That's an interesting point, is that, what are they preparing for? I mean, machine guns aren't going to stop a bomb.
Yeah, but I use that subway station. I have the same thought every time I go there.
They could stop
what
a guy
are
from,
they doing?
They could stop a guy from triggering a bomb.
They evacuated that station not long ago during the winter. And apparently there was some box that somebody had left in the train station, and it turned out it was completely harmless, but they actually shut the station for the better part of, I believe it was like 3 or 4 hours. And that's one of those real, that station is a labyrinth and it's just been renovated, so it's very difficult for people to figure out exactly where they're supposed to be going anyway.
It's hard to answer this kind of questions. You know, if threats are real, and obviously living in New York, you do feel a certain, ominous fear just from what we've been through as a city. It's these are hard questions to answer. But the one thing we know is that no one feels any safer, in this city. No one feels any safer in this country. And this president is running on a platform that he's tough on terror, that he's a wartime president. Well, it's become very clear to us anyways that he's losing the war on terror and people don't feel any safer.
I don't care who your vice president is. I don't feel any safer.
If you want to feel safe, you have to move to New Zealand.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey, it's beautiful. But, yeah, you can't live in a big city.
I wouldn't mind going to New Zealand, but what do I do on day 3? All right.
Australia.
Yeah. Here's our liberal agenda for today from the Streisand compound. Get your notebooks and your pens. Write these down. 1, screen airline passengers according to Aura. They've already instituted that.
Yeah, right.
2, change Captain Crunch to non-military cartoon serial spokesman for the children. 3, to cheer up Bill Clinton, gather with your rich Hollywood friends, and have him give the speech he couldn't deliver at Reagan's funeral. Have Carter open. 4, replace Republican convention hookers with lesbian sensitivity trainers. 5, finalize plans with Rosie O'Donnell for Broadway musical comedy called Fahrenheit 9-1 Fun. That's it for today. Do what you will. It's been great talking to you.
It's been real, if not regular.
Yeah, feel safe. Feel secure.
Feel safe. We didn't get again to the whole question of whether Rudy Giuliani is actually going to become vice president of the United States or at least a nominee. But we'll get to that tomorrow.
Gossip has it.
That's what gossip says. Coming up on tomorrow's morning's edition, we think Senator Frank Lautenberg will join us to talk about his non-proliferation push. We're not sure yet, but his guy's supposed to get back to us. Give us a call, Lautenberg's guy. That's tomorrow's morning's edition, maybe here on Air America Radio.